session number 27074, rule 17.
Squadronina Van Bamberger, reel 17. So how did you come to leave the squadron?
It was suggested to me one day, Rome had fallen, that by our wing padre, David Lewis, who was a Dominican monk, in actual fact, that I and someone else called wing commander Tony Lovell should go and visit Rome. And we had amongst our pilots someone who'd flown twin-engine bombers. His name I can't recollect. So we borrowed a bomber off the American 12th Air Force and piloted by this man's name I can't remember, Tony Lovell and David Lewis and I flew to Rome for a 10-day break. We stayed in San Clemente Pari, one of the oldest monasteries in Rome. It's actually on three levels. And there's only a few things just about it, maybe interest, in that the tranquility of the place after 3 or 4 years of war was unbelievable. Slightly amusing, we sat outside drinking and eating in the evening in the garden of this monastery, which is not far from, where's that place the gladiators used to fight?
Colosseum.
It's just by the Colosseum. And David, not me, started singing dirty RAF songs, so he'd always had a lot to drink. So I was somewhat embarrassed, so I retired to my room. But if after about 9 days there, if you'd have asked me if I'd wanted to take holy orders, I'd have probably said yes, because it was so different from my previous years of war. The peace, the relaxation, the tranquility, the contentment. You know, why I was there, again, due to the contacts through the Dominican prior, I had with Tony Lowell and David, we had a private audience with the Pope at the time. And then we returned home in our borrowed bomber. Now, this is where the problem starts. I got back, and I first of all took up an aircraft just to get my hand back and get some practice in. And I was somewhat startled or amazed, or every time the radio came on, a message from ground control or a message from the ground control to somebody else, I nearly jumped out of the cockpit. Couldn't understand this at all. So then I started doing operational flying again. We were escorting bombers up to northern Italy then, from Corsica again. And once again, every time the communications on the radio, it made me jump out of my skin. So I went to see the squadron wing doctor, Dr. Swan, and more or less asked him had he got any tablets for me. He took me to the 12th Air Force Hospital on Corsica, and they diagnosed I had a heart condition, which, of course, meant the end of my operational flying, which I found, you know, somewhat depressed. In fact, I was so depressed about it, I wanted to get away from the squadron, and within about 48 hours, I was back in Naples, because I didn't want to stand and talk and speak to anybody. So I got to Naples and had to wait for 3 or 4 days probably, which drove me mad, to see this consultant. Which, remember, of my age and another time, what I call neurology or anything like that never entered my head. I didn't know what it was, you know. Anyway, after very little time, obviously he was talking to me in simplistic language. He said, over the war years, you've been like a piece of elastic. You've been stretched and stretched and stretched. And he said, that rest in Rome, you relaxed, and now the rubber won't go back. And it was simple as that. He said, all you need is rest. So I came back to England with that prognosis. I'd have a medical board in England. And the suggestion was there that I should go to a nursing home for about 6 months. But I promptly told them that would drive me mad. Hanging about Rome, Naples had driven me crazy. I said, no, I've got to be doing something, resting. So I went to become a flying instructor, and my medical category would allow that. So they made a flying instructor out of me.
Was that just obviously you thought, as he'd explained, you'd really, because you've been operating for an awfully long time, haven't you? Operationally.
Yeah. And
were you aware of that kind of creeping up on you?
No, I had no idea of it at all. Until I had that rest in Rome, I had no idea. But I had one indication of it when I came back from Rome. In that I was sitting in our mess, our tent, and eating a meal, and an Australian was playing darts, and he missed the board, and the dart landed on my table, and I blasted him out of the tent. Well, that wasn't me. So it was an indication I'd come to the end of the road for my operational flying, wartime flying.
Because I think you went to number 7 flying instructor school at Upavon.
Yes.
On your return school.
Flying Oxfords. And they then sent me to...
Is it 20 AFU? At Kidlington?
That's right. They sent me to Kidlington and made me an instructor. Well, I was an instructor. One incident there worth describing how things operate. I was instructing a pilot with 3,000 hours on Oxfords. He'd been flying as an instructor in Canada for nearly the whole war. But coming back to this country, he had to go through this training unit. So I was instructor. We were low flying. I was letting him fly it, and he took half the wing off on a tree. I took over from him and landed it with half a wing at RAF Benson. And I got my log horse endorsed. Despite him having... I don't know how many hours I'd got on Oxfords. He was very, very much more experienced than I was as an instructor, not a pilot. But as I was the official instructor, I had Oxfords endorsed.
Obviously, there's not very many trees in Canada. With the flying instruction, obviously, you were training pilots for that period. What kind of daily routine would you have in that period?
Well, it was night flying and day flying. And to me, very boring. I didn't enjoy it at all. And The whole time I was there, you might have a time in there, but you have a time. I was sending signals out, verbally and on the tone, get me out of here. And the central gunnery, fighter wing. I flew up to see them in Oxford, and they say, we're just the man we want. So I went back to training fighter pilots to be gunnery instructors.
Have there been any changes since you'd done that in 42, 43?
When it first started, it was purely gunnery, teaching gunnery. It was divided up into, I think, three wings now. The gunnery wing, tactical wing, and some other wing, I can't remember what it was. So it had become a much bigger organisation. And it was all on one base, and it wasn't doing anything with... it was doing something, but that would be a bomber wing, operating with bombers.
What aircraft were you training with there?
Spitfires was the main aircraft, but we were flying Miles Masters to teach them gunnery, the same I'd been done with the Americans. That was my last mark I made in the Air Force, from my point of view, a personal point of view, because I arrived there between courses, and I was put in the gunnery wing, but all the instructors on all the other wing, the wing commander flying probably organised it. We'd have a shooting at drill competition, and I won it hands down. You know, there's about six squadron leaders, two wing commanders, and odd flight lieutenants. And I was streets head of them all.
Because obviously your shooting developed over the wartime period, hadn't it?
Oh, yes.
Would you say that a lot of that you gained from that first period when you were with Sailor Milan?
Oh, Sailor Milan did it. Because really, during the Battle of Britain and during Malta, even though you were learning on the job, you had not time to think of it as a skill. You were just doing it, to defend your country or defend what you were doing and save your life. You know, you hadn't time to think it through or anything like that. Or I hadn't, anyway.
Because it seems that, obviously, by this stage, in 1945, there was a lot more thought going into the idea of how to train a pilot. Did it combine all the various aspects that you'd encountered in your aerial?
Yes, it covered everything. And remember, though I think most people knew the war was going to end at that stage, these people who were turning out would be tactically trained. They'd know how to shoot. They'd approved it. They had to prove it on ground targets as well. One of the things there that I did was experimental, was using the modern gun sight. What do they call it? Gyroscopic gun sight. Using that to shoot rockets. I did the operational tests on doing that.
What aircraft were you flying to do that from?
Spitfires. But the whole thing, a rocket trajectory, is totally different because it's accelerating away in a different way. And you had to use the gyroscopic tack, totally different. And I can't remember how now, don't ask me. Yes, I forgot all about that until this. Isn't it funny?
So while you were there, the war came to an end.
From my point of view, because I left the Air Force from there.
Well, I was thinking actually with the war actually ending, how did you feel? Because you'd had a very long war, hadn't you?
Yes, I had a long war. All I remember on VE Day, I was duty officer or something. And all I had to do was go around trying to quell spirits.
And you took your demobilisation, did you, in 1945?
Yes,
what was the process with that?
Just going back just a little bit. I love flying. I love the Air Force. I'd have loved to have stayed in the Air Force. But two or three senior people with good war records had been down to Airminster or wherever they went to get commissions, and they'd been turned down. Well, I don't know whether I mentioned it earlier, I don't think so, but having left school at 14, I didn't think I had a chance. So that's why I went out of the Air Force.
But I believe, actually, you were involved again with the Auxiliary Air Force, weren't you? From
yes,
1947
I rejoined the Auxiliary Air Force in 47, and about 48 or 49, I became CO of 610 Squadron, the unit I joined as an AC-2.
How did you feel about that? Because that's quite a cyclic thing, isn't it, to return to where you started from?
Except for one other thing, which I don't think would... Yes, I'll mention it. It's almost the second most important... Forgetting my family, that is. It's the most important thing that happened to me. To become CEO of the squadron that I joined as what I call an uneducated... An immature boy to end up as CEO of it. It was wonderful. Now, the only thing that beat that, again, forgetting my family side, is after the war, a long time after the war, I had quite a lot of dealings with Mother Teresa of Calcutta, and she called me her guardian angel. And that's my number one mark. You can cut the writing bar, but I don't put it in.
Can you tell me how the squadron was organised while you were with it, when you were in that period? Because it was just the start of the Cold War, wasn't it? And did that have any effects on how an auxiliary squadron was organised?
Well, the Auxiliary Air Force after the war was much more serious than it had been pre-war. Because first of all, you were flying at that time either Spitfire 16s or 19s or 22s. And the operations you were doing, you were frequently flying in cloud and instrument flying. And so though it was a weekend air force, people who joined had to take it seriously. In other words, okay, you did have drunken parties from time to time, but certainly not if you were going to fly next day on the Sunday, Sunday was our main day to fly. So drinking was fairly restrained, except for particular parties at Christmas or something like that. If anybody didn't turn up fairly regularly, they were not asked to leave, they were pushed to one side and were not allowed to participate in certain things. In other words, it was no longer... you enjoyed it, the flying, but everybody had to take it seriously. You know, it wasn't just slap happiness as it had been sort of before the war. Then, of course, we converted to meteors. Now, that was not too difficult, because a meteor was, despite being a totally different airplane, a jet, everything totally different, to give you my own experience, possibly, of course, I had a lot of experience, and even if you include my flying instructor, I went over to an airfield there, Southport, where 611 Squadron was based. And they had a Meteor 7, a dual seater. And I went up flying in the front seat of that with someone I knew quite well in the back seat. And we did some circuits and landings and touchdowns and runs and getting as close to the sound bar as we could. You had cards and you went through every little thing. And I couldn't say how many times I flew. Say, then I went solo in the Meteor 7. After probably about two trips, I think, two flights, I then flew a Meteor 7 back from Woodvale, Southport, to Hooton Park. And by that time, our Meteor 4s had been flown in. I had a flying instructor. Each squadron had a regular officer flying instructor. He took roughly half the squadron. I took the other half of the squadron. And purely using cards, we instructed them and took them up. I can't remember. Certainly probably only about three times. And then they went solo. And converted the whole squadron to Meteors very quickly, safely, and not damaging one aircraft. I mean, easier than converting them to Spitfires.
How did the Meteor handle? Because obviously it's a jet aircraft. And
it's a solid aircraft. It was a beautiful aircraft. It had lots of engine power, of course. And a good solid platform in every way, from every. And it had this additional power, you know, all the time. I mean, and when we did this instruction with them, we used to do a single engine landing with them, you know. And, you know, but you always knew you had this power to get you out of trouble if you needed it. And again, landing, you touch your wheels down instead of, say, bouncing along or trying to get your tail down a bit far, you push your stick forward onto your nose or let it roll forward. You know, the landing of it was, I mean, it was much more easier aircraft to fly than a Spitfire, really, you know. It hadn't got the finer points of a Spitfire, but much easier to fly. And a nice aircraft to fly. I enjoyed flying the Meteor. My airbags in the Meteor were far better than they were in a Spitfire.
What was visibility like in the Meteor?
Oh, very good indeed, very good, yes. Nose down all the time, oh yeah. See everything. No problems at all.
And with landing, you mentioned landing, but Is there any problems or differences in landing with a tricycle undercarriage?
Well, it's much easier. Much, much easier.
The squadron, you mentioned quite a lot, obviously, before about the pre-war squadron. Where were the pilots coming from post-war?
Most of them were people who joined and trained as pilots in the Air Force, but in the lead-up to the war ending. There were very, not many of my sort of there may have been one or two of them had seen war experience, but none of them saw anything like myself.
So you're saying really people who were trained within the system, but really didn't see the
combat. That's right.
Because obviously what had happened to most of the pre-war pilots who had been in the squadron,
none of them at all.
You said obviously it was a much more serious...
Much more serious. It was no longer a flying club. You were flying operationally, and we used to join up with regular squadrons for exercises.
And the role would have been a fighter-interception role?
Yeah, fighter-interception.
Would you do the same sort of summer camps you did?
Yes, yes, we did exactly the same, but again, much more serious. I mean, for instance, I forget the summer camps, we did them. But this is how I came back into the Air Force. We were called up during the Korean War for 6 months, like the people have been going to Iraq now, you see. We were called up for 6 months, and we went over to Horsham St. Faith. And there were three regular meteor squadrons, Air Force meteor squadrons there, and so we had to compete with them. Obviously, we weren't up to their standard, but we had to, in 6 months, obviously we had to get up to their standards. And we used to, you know, take up 48 aircraft at a time. And, you know, you couldn't play around doing things like that. I'll tell you one exercise we did. Give you an idea. 48 meters in the air, above cloud, so at 30,000 feet, and a lot of cloud down to about 2,000 feet. And we let down in pairs after one another. And landed and turned on. But remember, the accuracy of flying and your speed and your loss of height all had to be, otherwise you're going to land on someone or catch someone up or someone going to run into you. So it was really, and they, of course they hadn't got, in meters we didn't have the high flown tech they've got now. So to bring 48 aircraft down in pairs, at, you were flying along, if I remember rightly, and you counted 10 seconds, I think, or something like that. Then you turned, flew to point A, where the ground control would say, start losing height, and that's when you start losing height. And it wasn't until you virtually came in to the near the circuit that controller would take over. Tell you, but when you broke that cloud, did you breathe a sigh of relief? Because you can imagine more or less 48 aircraft in cloud all coming down together. But what, I'm just putting the point, it was no longer playing games. And again, another thing I was proud of, during my time with 610 Squadron as CO, I didn't lose one pilot. My successor lost three.
Would you have considered yourself quite a disciplined CO as well?
I was probably more serious-minded than the average.
Was that from your war experience, would you say, or is it a
personal? Well, as my wife or my son would tell you, I always want to be on time. I always, I'm a bit of a stickler even now.
Obviously, work well within the squadron.
Yeah.
Really, what was last question in the sense of while you were with the squadron? What was your opinion of the pilots coming in the post-war period? Again, slightly different from the pre-war period.
The pilots coming in were quite good, and some had quite a bit of experience. The main problem was quite a few of them married, is trying to fit in what you call a Saturday and Sunday Air Force with married life. And I remember one person who I'd known during the war, and had quite a bit of war experience. He came from Stoke-on-Trent, where the squadron was at Huttenbach near Chester. And though I knew him, and he died about a year ago, I kept contact with him over years, I turned him down because I reckon he couldn't fit his married life and drive up from Stoke and Trent because he'd have to stay the night. So he'd be away from his family every weekend. And I said, no, it's not on.
So you would expect a certain amount of commitment?
If they couldn't give me a commitment, I wasn't interested. And some gave me the commitment and then didn't keep it.
How would you deal with those who couldn't keep the commitment?
Well, I didn't actually throw anybody out, but I just said certain things they couldn't take part in.
Sounds very different from what you described pre-war.
Yes, oh yes. Mm-hmm.